Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hi, OCD family community. Welcome back. It's April. Hard to believe, but I am here for it because April is Autism Acceptance Month. That means we are going to be not only recognizing and including, but respecting and supporting the neurodivergent experience, particularly when it comes to our OCD warriors, loved ones, and clients. So get ready, because today we get to welcome back the wonderful Dr. Stacy Greeter, MD, an OCD psychiatrist, as we talk about the importance of neurodivergent affirming care, medication considerations, and even the differences between a neurotype and a personality trait. Are you intrigued? I hope so, because this episode is chock full of such interesting and nuanced conversation, and I can't wait for you to hear more.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent, and let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
All right. Alrighty, welcome back, family. So it has been a wild couple of weeks, a wild month, a wild year thus far. If you're with me, if you feel me on that, just know you're not alone. Your girl Nicole here is definitely in the same boat. But I am excited for Autism Acceptance Month. For any newer fam joining, I am pretty open about how I am a mother of three autistic children, one of which has OCD as well. And my sweet kiddos have even been on the show before, which has been really fun for them and for us. So I'm doing my part and striving to be able to feature different autistic voices to celebrate, honor, and learn more about this intersection. And we're going to cover a lot of different topics today, but as a person with a very large neurodivergent community, there was a lot that I didn't know. And as in any conversation that we have here with the fam, I also don't want to generalize that just because we're talking about this subject, this paints and captures all autistic people or all autistic experience. No, it doesn't. Everyone is going to be individual. The spectrum is very individual, even within the same person, let alone across people. And so that is not my aim at all. But I'll tell you, here are some of the things I learned very, very right off the bat as I was learning more about my children, which honestly, I knew my children better than anyone. But understanding also that them being autistic had such a beautiful and varied array of challenges that they faced that we could face, none of them wrong, just different. And so I'm going to share with you a little bit about my experience, a little bit of what I've learned. And you'll hear even throughout the show as we talk with Dr. Stacy Greeter, I pull a couple different real life examples to try and help us break down or apply the concepts that we're discussing. So if you're like, she talks about her fam a lot. Yeah, I mean, we are the fam. We're hanging with the fam. And I tend to think some of those examples can be helpful to the extent that my kiddos are comfortable and consenting to their information being shared. So first off, let's talk about autism acceptance. You may have also heard this month referred to, or you may even be within the community and refer to it as Autism Awareness Month. But sometimes you'll hear autism acceptance, and so what's the difference? Are they all one and the same? I think that's a great question, and I'll just tell you from my perspective how I digest it, if you will. I think awareness is super important for so many things. I think awareness really sends a message that says, we know you exist. We see you. You're visible. And visibility is very, very important. Acceptance, however, communicates a little bit of a different message. Acceptance communicates you belong here, just as you are. And any other moms out there listening, looking at our precious kiddos, looking at our loved ones and going, yeah, you're damn right you belong here. We want people to see you, but we also want them to accept you. Not if you meet some kind of expectation, some kind of standard, but because you're you and you're the only you we've got. And you are pretty amazing. So sometimes we can get some big feelings, myself included, and get a little fussy about the differences between awareness and acceptance. No shame if you use one or the other. I'm just inviting you into my process of it and why I state acceptance. Ultimately, I hope it reflects a deeper goal that we're not just recognizing autistic people, but we're respecting them, we're including them, we're supporting them. And while awareness can sometimes focus on deficits or quote unquote fixing, acceptance centers around the autistic voices themselves, honoring neurodivergent experiences and promoting meaningful inclusion, whether we're talking about at work, home, school, in healthcare, and beyond. So the aim is not to change autistic people to fit the world. It's about changing the world to welcome everyone in. So with that little exposition, we're going to get ready to have this really important chat on a topic that I'm very passionate about. And again, if you've been with us for a hot minute, family, you've heard me talk about autism and give some love to the autistic fam. It is a year-round occurrence, but particularly at this time where we're celebrating, again, that you belong here just as you are. I definitely wanted to prioritize sharing amazing autistic voices with you. So for today, we are welcoming back our guest, a rainbow unicorn, as you'll hear us mention just at the end of our conversation. But she is an amazing asset and colleague and powerhouse for our field. She is a psychiatrist that understands OCD, autism, ADHD, as well as many other mental health disorders. But she is also an autistic ADHDer herself, or ADHD for short, and she has lived experience of OCD. So she speaks both from objective clinical purview and that lived experience purview. And I'm so excited to have her back with us today. We first met Stacy back in October, which is OCD Awareness Month. So I'm glad I get to pick her brain. And even more so, I'm glad that you guys get to hear from her. It's such a rare opportunity to be able to chat with our specialized psychiatrist. So thank you again, Stacy. So for those of you that are new to Meeting the Good Doc, let me take a moment to first remind you a little bit more about Stacy. Stacy is a board-certified medical doctor in both child and adolescent and adult psychiatry, and she owns a group practice in Sarasota, Florida, here in the United States. Dr. Greeter has an insatiable curiosity about her infectious enthusiasm for psychiatry and teaching. She employs metaphors and engages in storytelling to make complex psychiatric concepts relatable and entertaining through her psychoeducation fan fiction videos. And if you're like, did you say fan fiction? I did. She has amazing fantasy lore type presentations, be it for dragons, Lord of the Rings, you're talking rainbow unicorns. I mean, it's amazing. So I'm going to be linking all the information on her and her YouTube channel, her practice website, all of that over on this episode's blog, always found at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. And if you're watching or listening on YouTube, you can always find that link in the description below. And last but not least, before we dive into today's conversation, I'm just going to highlight a couple different terms because we're going to be talking about some different themes, some differences, particularly when we're talking about our autistic friends and family. We do refer to them as autistic. And you might have heard in prior years or maybe even recently, but from other people when discussing autism, oh, this is a person with autism. Okay, so why do I say autistic? And I think it's an important clarification because I'll say even when I was in graduate school, we were taught that we should say person with autism. You should not call somebody autistic. That's rude. That's pejorative. That's labeling. But you know what's interesting about that? It wasn't necessarily autistic people saying that. It was people thinking, we are kind of othering others. And so maybe that feels that way. And so it was decided primarily by non-autistic people to call people with autism. But many in the autistic community actually prefer identity-first language. They're not a person with autism, they're an autistic person. And so while some habits die hard and you may still hear people using person-first language, just know I'm going to lean into what autistic voices are saying. And not every person is going to be the same, so some people might not have a big preference either way. That's totally fine. I think when in doubt, ask about. Oh, I like that. I like the little turn of phrase. I just came up with it. When in doubt, ask about. Don't assume, just ask. How do you prefer to be addressed? Most people aren't going to be like, call me autistic. Some people might be like, you don't have to call me autistic Jimmy or Jimmy with autism. Just call me Jimmy. I'm good with Jimmy. So when in doubt, ask about. What is their preference? So we're going to be talking about a few terms today. And again, I generally try to kind of pause or along the way explain different terms. So first of all, we're talking about identity-first autistic people. And you'll also hear me reference the term allistic people. Now, what's allistic? Allistic is another way of referencing the broader population. In the past, this has been referred to as neuronormative or neurotypical. And again, if you've used those phrases before and you're joining this conversation, I'm glad you're here because we get to kind of explore what might feel like it fits or what it might miss when we're using those terms. So if you are a neuronormative person, what does that mean for someone with a different neurotype? They're abnormal. They're atypical. They're not part of the group. I don't think that when this, and I don't know what went behind or how people come up with names and how things kind of get solidified over time, but I don't think the intention initially was to try and seclude or other people. They were just trying to categorize and say, okay, this group processes this way and this group processes that way. But one group is the normal group and y'all are the abnormal, atypical, different. Other doesn't have quite the same ring to it, does it? And again, some people are going to be like, okay, whatever. And some people are going to be like, I care. Why am I not normal? Why is this the name? So allistic has become a way to reference the broader population without language that feels better than or prioritized or normalized, for lack of a better word. Also, we'll talk about when things are egocentric or egodystonic, because autism being your neurotype or whether you're an allistic neurotype, that's egocentric. It's congruent with who you are. It's part of you. It is your vibe. It is value driven. It's you being you, your authentic self. Egodystonic is when you might have a thought or a feeling, behavior that feels really incongruent with who you understand or desire yourself to be. It's not who you want to be. In fact, it's very distressing. Some might call it intrusive. Egodystonic. This is where OCD hangs. So being autistic is an egocentric, congruent, authentic representation of self. Being an autistic person with OCD, the autistic part is egocentric. The OCD is egodystonic. We'll also talk a little bit about stimming, which you may have heard of before, and you might be like, what is stimming? I've maybe heard it around. I've never heard it really defined. So stimming is really short for a self-stimulatory behavior. Some of the more classic stereotypic stims are going to be thought of even as some of these repetitive behaviors like hand flapping, humming, tapping, pacing, blinking. Stuff that happens to help regulate the nervous system. But also, stimming could look like knitting. Stimming could look like doodling. For some people, they might have a body-focused repetitive behavior, and as we call it here in the community, a BFRB may have a stimming quality. Stimming can take many different shapes and sizes, and it can vary, again, within a person or across people. So we'll talk about that, because as we start thinking about stimming, you can imagine, since it's regulating, it's a value-driven behavior. And because it's a value-driven behavior, for those of us that have been around the block a time or two with OCD, knows that OCD does tend to hijack and interfere with our value-driven living. So sometimes stims that function in a very regulatory way for an autistic individual may get hijacked by OCD and then also become distressing. This is not that dissimilar from OCD hijacking a hygiene practice like hand washing. So it's important to understand, because sometimes we need to be able to think creatively and curiously about where that line is. And Stacey and I are going to talk about all of that and more. But I just wanted to kick our time off with a little bit of a dictionary of sorts of some of the terms that we're going to be discussing. So with that context, and without further ado, I think we are ready for this great conversation because Stacey has a lot of really helpful insight and nuanced thinking. And I think it's really going to be helpful for so many. I know it is for me. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And I am super excited because we have a return guest from the beginning of season three. If you caught any of our OCD Awareness Month episodes, we were honored to have Dr. Stacey Greeter, who is a psychiatrist, and she happens to specialize in the intersection of OCD and really understanding OCD as a psychiatrist, as well as autism, ADHD, and she treats a lot beyond that, so I don't want to fail to mention that. But as we are kicking off Autism Acceptance Month, I am so excited to have her back. So thanks for joining us, Stacey. I'm excited to have this chat.
Thanks so much, Nicole. Yeah, I'm a child and adolescent and adult psychiatrist, and I enjoy combining meds with some psychotherapy and collaborating with other therapists. And I also am autistic, ADHD, and OCD myself as a patient.
Yeah. And so you can speak from lived experience, but you also have all of that clinical experience and insight. And, you know, family, if you've ever been to an IOCDF conference or if you attend occasionally some of the online webinars, you may even be familiar with Stacey because she is doing so much to help educate the broader public about these really important intersections. And so I'm thrilled to have you here today, particularly as we zoom in to have a better, more full understanding. This is something that I talk about year round, so it's not just an April feature for me, but I'm really excited to talk about the autistic community, how that can intersect with how OCD presents. Again, it's going to range, just as OCD would for anyone, it's going to range in how it presents. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to start off with is just discussing the importance of neurodivergent affirming care and really what is neurodivergent affirming care. And so would love if you could help the listening audience here have a better understanding what our goal or goals may be when we're approaching a client. And I feel like this should be with any client, but particularly for our autistic clients or our ADHDers, how would you describe neurodivergent affirming care?
Sure, that's a great question. Thanks, Nicole. So comparing and contrasting neurodiversity affirming model with what we call the traditional medical model, though I would love to call it instead to make people neurotypical models so as to not be as stigmatizing to the medical profession as a whole, since some medical professionals are practicing a neurodiversity affirming model. So the neurodiversity affirming means that we honor there's more than the neurotypical way to live a meaningful and fulfilling life. Neurotypical referring to the most common neurotype or brain type versus less common brain types like autism, dyslexia, and ADHD. So the primary goal of the more historical model of care would be for an individual to be the closest approximation of the average brain type. And the goal of a neurodiversity affirming model is for the individual to be their most fulfilled, functional, and authentic self. So how that works practically, for example, would be engaging in stimming and going deep into special interests is very fulfilling and emotionally regulating for an autistic person. And an ADHD person may need to shift and add, you know, extra stimuli like music to a task to get their extra stimulation to focus. So that's going to look different for them versus a treatment model where we are trying to get the ADHD person to do the focus like other people do it or trying to get an autistic person to not engage in stimming as much or their special interests as much.
Yeah.
So the goals of treatment are different. Mm-hmm. And then as well, neurodiversity affirming care has a different relationship, I think, between the professional and the patient. Mm-hmm. So we are engaging the patient as an expert on themselves mm-hmm. in a more collaborative relationship. And it really is putting a lot of emphasis on autonomy of the patient in directing their goals in treatment and really approaching people from a sense of intense curiosity, because the practitioner may have a very different perspective and brain type than the patient. And so we need to be extra curious, making less assumptions that we are the expert who knows exactly what's going to work for them. And instead, we're engaging them as co-explorer with us in deepening our understanding of them.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And, you know, it's something that Stacey and I were discussing before we started recording, fam, is that's what I feel like we should be doing in treatment anyway, right?
Because, I mean, honestly, yes.
Right?
Whether you're autistic or not, or you're ADHD or not, or whatever, right?
Right.
I think that when you're sharing a different brain type than the average brain type, there's just more potential for harm when we don't use that very curious, collaborative, and autonomy-supporting approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because when we look at something like OCD, and for anybody that's newer to the treatment side of OCD that's listening, it's really important for us to do different functional behavioral analysis and see how the OCD is functioning. How is the obsession or the compulsion or the avoidance functioning in a situation? Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, it's not different to go, well, how is that functioning for you? But there are some biases and perceptions that people don't always realize they have, that they would assume you're doing this, that must be compulsive.
Right.
When maybe that's a regulatory behavior, or maybe there is a line of figuring out how CD is coming in and trying to hijack that value-driven regulatory skill or soothing or stim or special interest for this distressing, really ego-dystonic application, which is what is happening when OCD is taking hold.
Yeah, and it gets tricky. I had it explained, I thought very well, in the question, do you want to be doing something or must you be doing it because of a trap as a distinction? And I think also the another one to add on would be, or do you need this? Right, for regulation. And so on the surface, the exact same repeated behavior can serve so many different functions for an individual, whether it's a compulsive, I am trapped.
Right.
Okay. Whether it's an emotionally regulating, I need this, it's helpful. Whether it's a really stimulating, enjoyable, I want to do this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then with people who have limited insight, right? And you know, it's hard to say. You can see the OCD behavior sometimes, at least the individual believes they're egocentric, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's little insight and they're so wrapped up in the OCD narrative too.
Right.
Right. Versus of someone with greater insight and isn't as wrapped up in the OCD narrative, it's a very ego-dystonic behavior to them.
Yeah. You tell me if you feel like this example fits. So my son has been on the podcast. He is autistic.
Cool.
He is an autistic ADHDer as well and has OCD. And when he was young, he would really have a hard time with loud noises. And he still does, but he's done an incredible amount to help himself expand with tolerance of certain noises or ask for headphones or advocate for
his needs. For himself.
Yes.
Cool.
which is okay. Absolutely. And it's important. In fact, it's something we want any of our clients to be able to do, is if they're having a need to be able to advocate for what that need is. And so we used to go to a restaurant, and if somebody across the restaurant was singing happy birthday, he'd get really worried that somebody was going to have a birthday because that felt so loud to him. And so what we noticed over time, perceiving this initially as just a sensory sensitivity, this is a painful noise for him, he needs support in it. We noticed OCD hijack over time, because over time it became, I can't go anywhere and not have headphones because I won't be able to survive and the world is going to be painful. Now, I don't want to delegitimize that.
Right.
His experience of sound and how his brain was processing it, I'm sure it was very painful. But also OCD was like, you're not safe anywhere because sound is going to be everywhere. So a lawnmower down two blocks away that you can faintly hear now was this very scary thing. And it was one of those things that once we discovered the OCD, and he also did some work in occupational therapy to help kind of integrate some of those sensory sensitivities, he was empowered to be able to be like, you know what, I can go out, it's fine, it's not too loud. And if it is loud, you know what, I'm just going to cover my ears or ask for some headphones, which is beautiful.
Right.
He feels some choice and industry over how he can handle it.
Yeah.
And the world went from shrinking to be very small to opening back up.
Yeah. I think you bring up a great point. And I think we need to be really curious and also really nuanced in how we approach the neurodiversity affirming model of care, because some people will misinterpret neurodiversity affirming as meaning we are 100% always accommodating the autistic individual. And so in that example, your son needed to be pushed, right, to be able to engage with the world more and also accommodated, where if it got too loud, he could use his headphones. So I think we're going to do autistic people actually a disservice if our treatment plan only includes accommodation in all circumstances, especially for when we're treating anxiety and OCD, etc. Yeah, I don't know if you've encountered that too as kind of an issue, right? And that we need to really think complexly about when we are supporting people and kind of pushing themselves and stretching themselves and gaining empowerment and mastery and exposure, and when we are supporting and accommodating.
Absolutely agree.
Which like, that's not easy to figure out.
It's not easy, but OCD treatment isn't necessarily easy in and of itself, right? If you're just thinking about like some of the nuances, right? And honestly, neurodivergent, or whether we're talking more broadly of just the allistic population, we all have special nuances that are going to kind of land with us in different ways. And so being curious, I think, is one of the main important
things.
And asking, like, let them lead in that and be empowered that they know themselves best.
Exactly.
Right.
And well, I think even that's nuanced. I think in some ways, people know themselves best. And then in many ways, people can be really wrong about themselves.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
You know,
so it's like it's all really gray. It's like if people were 100% on themselves all the time, I think we wouldn't have a job anymore as mental professionals. Yes. And then I wouldn't need to go pay my psychiatrist and my therapist to do my treatment, because I'd just be great.
Let
me tell you, like, I'm totally wrong about myself sometimes too. So, I mean, even that, I think we need to be nuanced in how much I think we should always hold both our perspective on what's going on with the patient with curiosity and the patient's perspective on what's going on with them with curiosity.
Oh, I would absolutely agree. And, you know, what I would say is, from an OCD standpoint, and one of the things I know you and I previously have spoke a little bit about, inference-based CBT. And what I really love about inference-based CBT for the treatment of OCD is I kind of feel like it's somewhat a love letter to yourself to say you can trust yourself, particularly within the autistic population, in my experience. And I will just say that all my kids are autistic. And so it is normal for our household, absolutely, to, be neurodivergent. But what I will say is there's so much feedback coming from the world that people, I would say it's a privilege to not realize how much feedback that you walk in and someone squints and they say, it's not bright in here. Stop that. I'm cold. It's cold in here.
It's true. And it's like we learn to gaslight ourselves constantly as autistic people because that's what happens. Like, it's not really my experience.
So a lot of the peer learning that can be helpful, when you see how peers are responding to something, also can perpetuate that sense of masking for a lot of autistic people going, I need to fit in and Jimmy is just doing this, so I need to do it like that, right? Not because it feels authentic per se to what that person is doing at the moment, but because Jimmy is getting rewarded for being like Jimmy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but I feel like I need to try and be Jimmy and put all of my effort into presenting in a certain way. And I think so many people in different intersections feel this, whether it's in the queer community or the BIPOC community, within the neurodivergent community of like, I have to put on a certain face and act a certain way to not stir up trouble. And even if someone listening is like, no, but that wouldn't be trouble. You're not living in that person's shoes where you're getting that feedback constantly. What I will say is in previous conversations, and you and I were talking about our friend, Dr. Jeremy Schumann before, we've talked with the OCD family community before about this as a liberation-oriented need for treatment for neurodivergent folks. And I would just say anybody. We need to have access and ability to access accommodations or supports, but we don't get to choose for someone whether they use it or don't use it. And they need to be able to have the freedom and industry to choose for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so one of the examples I've used on the show before and with the community before is my father doesn't walk very well. He's not very stable, has some neuropathy and some other health conditions. And so he is supposed to use a walker, supposed to. But sometimes for his own sense of like dignity, he wants to stand up and walk across a room by himself. Now, this can make us all worry because we could go, you could fall. And if you break a hip, that could be.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. Right. But at the same point, when he has so little control over so much in his life, he needs access to the walker, absolutely. And it should be there and available. But if he chooses, ultimately, to use it or not, if he parks in a handicapped spot and uses the ramp or not, that ultimately he gets the ability to have that choice. And so I think similar to what you were saying in terms of we should have exposure, we should have some choice here, but it's not that everything should be accommodated. It's like there needs to be some freedom to make that choice and to be able to trust yourself. And I think so many people do struggle to be able to trust themselves.
Yes. Okay. So like historically, there's so much medical gaslighting.
Yeah.
So much trauma, so much internalizing this sense of being wrong, being broken, not being able to trust our own perception in the neurodivergent community. Mm-hmm. And we really need to be very mindful aware of that. I just think that what we also need to be mindful of when we're doing neurodiversity affirming care is that we're not doing the neurodivergent population a disservice by not being also curious about how might this person be wrong sometimes too? How might this person need to be challenged instead of accommodated? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I don't want us to reactively shift too far in the other way and then also do people a disservice when we're providing them care. And so there's this balance. in the majority of cases all across the medical system, we really need to stretch ourselves more towards accommodation, support, and understanding that person's, it comes from a place of really engaging them as an expert on themselves. But then, like in the example with your dad, we want to respect his autonomy as much as possible. And he has the autonomy to move around as he sees fit. But there's also in the world, we don't exist in a vacuum. And we also may need to understand, like, how does it impact you when he's not using his walker, right?
Right.
And then helping him understand your perspective on that. So we're not just like, yes, good for you with your autonomy, but here are some other perspectives too that maybe he's not thinking of.
Right.
I hope. Yeah. What do you think though?
We have the right and ability. And I think it's important to go, Dad, if you fall and break your hip, that's it.
Yeah.
We don't like this. Doesn't feel
safe. That impacts
safe.
You a lot.
That doesn't feel safe. We want you around for a while here.
Right.
Right. We're allowed to say that. That still means he has a choice on whether or not he walks with the walker.
True. And but there's also like it's you take into perspective.
Yes.
You take into account both perspectives and both needs of the neurodivergent individuals and the so-called neurotypical individuals.
Yeah. You know, I came across a similar example. In my mind, it feels similar. And I would love to hear your thoughts on it, particularly as a psychiatrist. I have a child, I'll just say, one of my children. All of my children have ADHD in my purview. And all of my children are autistic. And when this particular child had their autism diagnosis, they said, you know, there's some impulsivity and there's some hyperactivity, but outside of what I would expect for an autistic person. And my response was, okay. And still, though, this child deserves access to supports, right? And so the question that we were debating at the time was whether or not he might benefit from being on a stimulant medication because the siblings were on a medication.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided not to do the medication at that time, per the psychologist's recommendation, et cetera. But I never felt quite calm about it.
Did he get a diagnosis or we were like of ADHD?
Not of ADHD, of
no.
autism.
No, autism, but not ADHD.
Right.
Okay.
And I tried to advocate.
But was it an ADHD medicine that your guys were? Sorry.
Well, the stimulant medication, because in my opinion, I was seeing ADHD. And
you were seeing ADHD. Okay, they just didn't diagnose him with it, but they recommended ADHD meds.
And they recognized it was there, but they had some other learning disabilities. And so the feedback was, this is kind of what we expect in this presentation. And I said, I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I think that.
Yeah. Is that like, this as good as it gets? You should just settle.
It felt like that.
Right. Is that kind of what you heard? Anyway,
and as a parent, I was like, no, I think that this child is capable of more, but needs some support, needs some of the support.
Right.
Long story short, a couple years goes by. School is just getting harder and harder. We're having more and more anxiety, more awareness with other learning disabilities, too, that we're just not functioning the way our peers are functioning. And I was like adamant and took the child into the doctor and said, you know, there's so much anxiety here. And I totally validate why it's there. And this child deserves support and needs some additional support. So we were looking at perhaps an SSRI. And the pediatrician said, which I don't always grant that, nothing against pediatricians, but they have different levels of different mental health disorders. The pediatrician said, well, I bet if you treated their ADHD, a lot of their anxiety would go down.
Right.
Right. And then this.
Which kind of makes sense.
Right. And I was like, you know, it's interesting you say that.
Dang.
Because I said that too. Long story short, the child started a stimulant medication and it has made a profound difference, even with the learning disability. because
yeah.
their brain was able to slow down and focus, register some of the things, moving through the information and already having some of those processing challenges from the learning disability. Yeah. And part of what ruffled me is I felt, and maybe I was, maybe this is on partly on me on how I interpret it, but part of it felt like, okay, your child's autistic. What do you expect?
Yeah. And it makes me mad too. And a lot of times, like the other thing is when we're providing neurodiversity affirming care, okay, just like people can have neurotypical blinders and not understand the autism, people can like have autistic blinders and think, oh, it's all autism.
Right.
What you gonna do?
Right.
It's just autism. You can't make any changes, deal with it because it's autism kind of attitude.
Right.
Right. And so when you're treating autistic people, you're treating more, you're not, okay. So when you're caring for an autistic person, there is most of the time much more at play than just autism to take into consideration. And
right.
we should not have autistic blinders.
Right.
And so it's frustrating.
It is. Yeah.
And I always tell people, don't settle.
Right.
Yeah.
Here in the States, it can show up too in individualized education plans, otherwise known as IEPs. And, you know, I with lots of different things changing in the education system, there was a new law here in our state that a certain test needs to be passed or you're retained until you pass it. And with certain learning disabilities, I was like, my child isn't going to pass this. And so I brought it up at an IEP meeting. And they said, well, being autistic is no longer a valid kind of excuse for a waiver on this. And I was like, good to know. What does that have to do with our case?
Yeah.
And so they were like, well, I mean, they are autistic. And I said, but that's not why.
Yeah, you're like, that's not what's going what okay, right. we get it. And
that talks about why maybe they process the frustration right. the way they do,
like,
or they regulate
like,
the way they do. That has nothing to do with their intellectual ability or the fact that they have other diagnosed learning disabilities.
Yes. It's not, you know, someone you can't just see the autistic person through the lens of autism.
Right. Which is so often I feel like what happens. So neurodivergent affirming care, not to make it all about just my family here, Stacey, but neurodivergent affirming care, I find some of those examples can be helpful. The assumptions on both sides, and sometimes the assumption from the person themselves of what they are capable of or not, because they have heard over time what they're capable of or not, has to be a part of the consideration. And we have to be curious enough to wonder, mm-hmm. with the client, with the patient, how something is functioning, whether it is productive and value-driven and useful in their life, whether it's distressing and something where we can see with OCD or other mental health or physical health disorders, this is a result of that, or sometimes both. And you're right, it is messy and nuanced, but such is life, messy and nuanced, right? And So some of those difficulties show up when we're talking about neurodivergent affirming care. Hey, fam. This month, we're celebrating neurodivergent voices here at OCD Family Podcast. And if you're a part of our Replay fam, it's never too late. Because this month, and every month really, we're all about acceptance, inclusion, and respect. Autistic people are not puzzles to solve. They're people to listen to, learn from, and stand with. So don't forget to check out Dr. Stacey Greeter's YouTube channel while you're at it, because having a better understanding for the autistic experience, complex mental health disorders, or medication can be so helpful. And now, back to the show. Similar, again, to other intersections as well, there is, as you were saying before, when you were like, some providers are actually really good at this, so let's not shade all providers, but the medical model and the history of the medical model with the neurodivergent population has not been great either. And so in terms of, we look at things such as ABA therapy, we look at different classifications such as Asperger's, such as someone is a person with autism versus autistic. There's a lot of misunderstandings out there in terms of what could be helpful versus what is harmful. And so still today, one of the main recommendations is going to be if you go through any kind of neuropsychological evaluation, which is typically where you'll get an autism or ADHD diagnosis, is going to be ABA therapy. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on ABA therapy and really professionally what you would recommend in a situation. I know it's going to vary and depend on the client.
Right.
But just kind of initial thoughts.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. And I think this is something we also need to approach with the complex mindset. And okay, so some complexities to this are many families, all they have access to is ABA therapy. And I want to honor those families who are doing the very best they can to get their child help. Okay. And then I also want to highlight some of the concerns about ABA at the same time. As I say, it stands for Applied Behavior Analysis. And so traditionally, ABA's focus is on compliance and getting the autistic through analyzing what reinforces a behavior and what extinguishes a behavior, and then changing what the triggers so that behavior isn't triggered so much, or changing the reinforcers so a behavior isn't reinforced so much. And I'm hoping we can expand to work more relationally. So the concern is that when you are focusing on behavior and behavior looking as neurotypical as possible, we can cause harm because a child may mistrust what their natural instincts are to regulate themselves and learn to mask or appear as neurotypical as possible. Mm-hmm. I think that behavioral therapy is a very, I want to distinguish applied behavior analysis, ABA, from behavioral therapies as a whole,
right?
Okay, which simply means we're understanding what increases and decreases certain behaviors. And behavior therapy can also refer to behavioral activation, you know, where we're getting people to go out and about in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to conflate the two as like all behavior therapy is bad. Mm-hmm. Okay. I definitely don't want to leave that with that impression. I do think that there's a role for behavioral techniques in the treatment of like all human beings, honestly.
Right.
Right. We do it all the time. Anyone who's a parent, right, has worked to change their child's behavior and try to not trigger certain behaviors and try to not reinforce certain behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that we're not doing anything behavioral is bonkers.
Right.
Also. Okay. The crux to try to be, I can't say it more succinctly. I think the core issue is what is the ultimate goal / intention of the treatment, mm-hmm. right? Is it a compliant individual who looks as neurotypical as possible? Or is it a fulfilled, more connected, more emotionally regulated, expressive, able to advocate for themselves individual, and making an attempt to understand, be curious about, fully understand the person's experience and the purpose of a particular behavior in their life before we try to extinguish it, change it, is really important. I hope that made sense.
It did.
I did a lot of talking. Yes.
No, I think it did make sense.
And I mean, with insurance, with like a lot of families, you know, maybe that's all they have access to as a therapy, and they want their kid to behave as best as possible so they don't get kicked out of school or end up in jail, or, you know what I'm saying? It's so like, I want to like hold space for those people who are just doing the best they can for their kids.
That also went to a doctor or an expert that said, this is what you should do. And they're just trying to do what they were told is best.
Yeah. And add to the complication, let me tell you, there's a lot of quote, they're calling it ABA therapy.
Right.
So that, God bless them, so that like they can get insurance to pay for it so these families can access it and it's not ABA therapy. And there's a great fear in the parenting community that, like, understandably, like, I understand, of course, neurodiversity affirming movement is like, whoa, you know, ABA can be so harmful. And then these families are like, well, you know, what if you take away these therapies for me? That is all I have access to, right? Where people are calling it ABA so that families have insurance access and it's not really ABA.
Well, and if you...
So yeah, it's so complicated, you know?
It is complicated. And in some situations, you know, a child may be in danger in a home where maybe their family system does not, or their caregiver does not understand their behavior. And going into an ABA center and learning, but also having that break and respite from caregiver that doesn't understand, can in certain situations reduce harm if they are out in a different space where conflict resolution may turn into something that, you know, unintentionally or intentionally so, depending on a situation, could grow to a level of being an abusive situation. But the problem is too, I find there's disparate differences across ABA centers, and some are licensed and some aren't.
Yeah, like anything, you know.
Like anything.
There's so much variety.
Yeah.
Yes. And I just think it's like behavioral treatments are a piece, tool, I think, to be incorporated with heavy doses of curiosity,
right?
Relationship building. Like you do as a parent, right? It's the same thing you do as a parent with your child.
In any relationship, we can do it with our spouses, our partners.
You know what I'm saying?
Our parents. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, again, I have a lot of grist from the mill to pull from in terms of examples. But an example of this, where, again, I think it's important. It's really, really important to not just go, oh, because it could be behavioral. And like you're saying, this is just kind of part of how our brains are naturally going to learn, autistic or not. We're going to learn through different experiences, engagement with the environment. But when you were giving that example, it made me think of an OT goal that one of my children had at one point. It was time for their, you know, update, and the OT evaluator came out and said, yeah, so I was thinking we could do, let's reduce meltdowns from 10 to 5 minutes. And these are some of the interventions that we'll use.
You know how to do that.
Right. And so they were like, if you're good with that, let's sign off on it. And I said, well, I'm glad you asked, because I don't think I am good with it.
Yeah, right.
And they were like, what? You don't want to reduce meltdowns? And I was like, well, I would love for my child to feel more regulated.
Yeah.
Which I think naturally would reduce
what does that mean? It's a stopwatch, and you're like, time to stop having a meltdown.
Right. You've had your 5 minutes. Move on. I was like, first of all, point to me an adult that would tolerate that. I mean, these kids have so little choice. If somebody cut you off in traffic and I was like, you're mad, but you have 2 minutes. And then you're done being mad, or else you'd be like, or else what? Shut up. Right.
Yeah. That's going to decrease the length of my meltdown.
Right. Exactly. Nothing makes you feel better than a nice shaming comment. Right. And so I said, you know, I have no problem with the child. And in fact, I welcome that open curiosity of what do I need right now? Maybe what I need is to say, I feel mad because I was doing this really fun regulatory thing, and now I'm going to have to go do this hard thing that I'm working on in OT. And I don't want to stop doing the really fun thing to work on the really hard thing. And I think from, you know, just surface value, all of us can relate to that. I want to stop doing something fun to do something hard that's challenging, mm-hmm. that may vex me, right? But I think we'd get a lot farther if the child was able to go, you know what, I'm feeling sad and I need a minute to feel sad because I didn't want this part of the fun to stop. But also having some of that advance notice and then knowing we're going to be able to come back to a more, you know, preferred activity afterwards. Like a lot of, at least with my own kids, I can say a lot of kids are pretty good with it if they just have that advance heads up. And they're right. Like, yeah, I don't like it, but it's not going to be forever. You don't communicate that, then it might as well be forever. And who isn't going to, quote unquote, melt down, be upset? That's their word for being upset. I am all for them being upset. We're allowed to be upset as humans. And so it's one of those examples where we go, behaviorally, there's still things and shifts that we could, essentially what they wanted was a smoother transition in a smaller amount of time. But there are a lot more affirming ways that we can empower you to understand why that transition's hard, and that even though it is going to be hard, there's going to be other transitions to look forward to in the future. And I at least have an idea of the schedule, or I have a visual schedule, and I can process that versus just feeling like I'm getting yanked away from something I really enjoy. And so there are ways to do it, but it can feel very, very challenging. And something that has developed more as of late in understanding like pathological demand avoidance and how the nervous system is responding. A lot of that can be addressed through just providing some age-appropriate information to the person of understanding what's happening in their body, understanding what's upsetting, understanding for maybe parents, teachers, loved ones, how our language can reinforce this idea of distress through a demand or request. And it can feel very, very challenging for people to wrap their minds around. But I think that's where we got to go. Okay, well, the good news is you don't have to figure it out all by yourself. You can work with your client. And together, just through the process of being open, curious, you can help figure out how things are functioning and let that help guide the way.
Yeah. And so I don't want us to withhold behavioral techniques and treatments from the larger picture. And I just want us to have the goal of treatment to be the person's most fulfilled, authentic, and functional self. While we prioritize that, their authenticity, their understanding of themselves, other people's understanding of them, accommodation of their needs that balances accommodation of neurotypical needs, and being in relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. But I don't want us to say, I don't think we should withhold behavioral strategies from helping people live their most fulfilling lives.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think that's probably it's painting with a broad stroke, but that's probably my main discomfort.
I think we're saying the same thing, by the way. Yeah. I was just clarifying because I get frustrated.
I do too. I do too.
You could tell. I'm like, I feel like there's ways in which the social justice movements can be harmful, and ways in which they can be incredibly empowering.
Right. Yes.
With sometimes black and white thinking can be harmful. And then they're also incredibly empowering to get people to think differently.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's more about right? What are we doing holistically for people?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Hey fam, if you're loving these conversations, especially during Autism Acceptance Month, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast. Whether you're tuning in on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your pods, hitting that follow button helps more people find neurodivergent affirming content like this. Now, let's get back to it. And thinking about this, it's an interesting kind of bridge as we kind of think about it holistically, but we also kind of bridge into your specialty when we think about medication. Mm-hmm. And And one of the things we discussed about even before last time you were on the show is, when is medication right for a person, or when should it be considered as part of a treatment plan? And for some of these individuals within the autistic or ADHD, or particularly in that comorbidity, some of these folks have been on medication most of their life. Some haven't been on a medication. But again, I think it's a good question to kind of ask ourselves, what role or how should medication play a role? And again, similar, you know, to the autistic community, there's going to be different individual strengths or different case considerations that we're going to have to clinically consider for that. But what have you observed in terms of the role of medication and its helpfulness, or some of the difficulty that can come in around medication, particularly when we're thinking about our neurodivergent clients with OCD?
Okay. So the question is how we are making decisions about when to start medication. Okay. I think if it's going to help you lead a more fulfilled and meaningful life, then yes, medicine.
Right.
Which I know it's a very simple answer and broad answer, but yeah, you know, does medication help you lead a healthier, more fulfilling, more meaningful life? And then, I mean, maybe circling back for a more specific example, you mentioned your son with ADHD. I hear a lot of therapists, unfortunately, say medicine should always be a last resort. I'm like, why? Why should we not do something that can be incredibly helpful mm-hmm. and impactful? And I mean, just to show some of the nuance, when we're doing kind of a risk-benefit analysis for medication, an article, we'll go with ADHD meds, I guess. And there's studies that show that the longer years you're on ADHD medication, you have a higher risk for high blood pressure. So then you might be like, oh, well, the healthiest thing is to not be on the ADHD meds. However, other studies show that ADHD people who take stimulant medication specifically have longer life expectancy by about 13 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, lower all-cause mortality, it's called. Why? Because they actually engage in healthier behavior. They have lower risk of car accidents, lower risk of unemployment. Okay, so you see how it's complex and we can't just look at one aspect of the situation. Like, big picture, what is going to help you live your best life? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can try the medication and see if it helps and adds to you living a better life.
Right.
Or not. Yeah.
And you don't have to be like, I have to know the answer because there's no going back. You could trial a medication.
Yeah, I know. Like I say,
guidance.
You're dating the medicine, not marrying it.
Right. Right. And I'm sure you've heard parents and I'm sure you've heard adults even go, I don't want to be dependent. I don't want them to be dependent on a medication. So when you hear that question, what advice or feedback would you have for a person that is concerned about that?
Do you know which medicine they're concerned about, or just in general?
I've heard about it more with a stimulant, but I've heard it with SSRIs and other things as well, where they're like,
yeah, and the concern again is,
I shouldn't need this to function. So if I have to take it now and I can only function on it, then I'm going to be stuck on it my whole life.
Oh, okay. So this is where they conflate the need for medical treatment as a personal character flaw, right? Like, the shoulds are always so dangerous in our life, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right? And I say, and people may have a fantasy that they can rid themselves of their particular diagnosis by refusing medication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our choice lies not in whether or not we have a particular diagnosis. Unfortunately, it's not a choose your own diagnosis adventure this life. Wouldn't that be nice? I would get rid of some of mine. you know, some of them keep, some of them discard.
Yeah.
Our choice really lies in whether we take responsibility for the full treatment for something. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. It makes sense to not want to take meds, right? Mm-hmm. And to have a fantasy that we could poof into this healthier version of ourselves without medicine, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of influence and there aren't a lot of choices we can make and therapy we can do to help. Mm-hmm. But it takes, ironically, I think, greater courage and greater strength to recognize our limitations and accept those and accept where we're at and accept help and support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I got in a Reddit conversation, always productive. I didn't get in a debate per se, but somebody was making a comment about medications for OCD. And they were, and a commenter said, well, I'm not on medication because I decided to do the hard work of therapy. And I was like, well,
take medicine as a support.
Yeah, I was like,
it doesn't take courage.
Right.
It doesn't take resilience.
Absolutely.
It's nothing. And also the idea that meds will just do the work for you. They'll just go, ta-da. No.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? I heard magic wands don't exist, but I'd be thrilled to find out that they do. Yeah. No, medication isn't a magic wand, but you're right. It does take incredible work. And for some people, it's just going to be a necessary piece of the puzzle.
I know, man.
Right.
Yeah. And therapists can get in the game here and talking to people about their fears of medication, their hopes for medication, their stigma about medication, whether medication symbolizes that they're bad or flawed,
yeah,
or that they're going to be controlled, or that it's just going to ta-da things for them. Yeah, fruitful stuff.
It's interesting because I moved to the provider area where I am now from Los Angeles. So there was a very different viewpoint or stance on medication, treatment, therapy from where I am now in the Midwest. Yeah. But I remember when I first moved here and before I was practicing again, I was taking care of babies at the time at home. But I had met some friends and there were a number of people that had loved ones that had ADHD. There's some private schools that really didn't get it. Talk about reinforcing the masking. They were like, what? We only take Stepford children here. That's probably a gross over characterization. But what was interesting to me, and it was kind of a bit of a crunchier area in terms of, let's try some of these other remedies. And so people were spending a lot of money on essential oils. They were spending money on vision therapy. They were trying to do biofeedback for ADHD.
It's hard and it's predatory, you know?
People play
on the stigma and it's like, drug-free, blah, 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 right, blah thing, you know? And I'm just like, guys, okay, you want to try some non-medicine options. Okay, you know, healthy lifestyle, exercise, meaningful activities, healthy relationships,
yeah,
healthy nutrition. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and it's
not like the shiny whatever, right, you know, therapy thing.
Well, and I, in a conversation, and I, even from cognitive behavioral therapy, and again,
right,
behavioral learning is not the enemy here, you know, and it's all in the nuance, right, of how it's applied and presented. But I said, you know, there are lots of things you can do to support a child. In this example, there were a lot of other parents I was talking to.
Also, I mean, studies across the board show that, like, intensive behavior therapy doesn't make a huge difference until medication is on board. And then once the medication is on board, helping with attention regulation and impulse control, the behavioral therapies can make a much, much larger difference.
Right.
So
very meaningful game changer differences.
Potentiating it hugely. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Right. So we're not saying that behavioral therapies are useless, but you may need medicine to get benefit from them.
Or you scale back your goal considerably, right? So I, you know, one of the things I said was, you know, if you're giving 10-step directions because they're an age where you feel like they should be able to get that and their attention was lost on step 3, then maybe you need to start with smaller directions, right? You can make that adaptation. But what was interesting to me was some of these, and some were very costly, like you said, predatory, kind of preying on the fear and the concern. And these parents are getting negative feedback from school teachers or whatnot for their kid just having their brain, right? They're just riding the waves of their neurocircuitry. And that doesn't mean that people that have ADHD, for example, are in control of their behavior or have no personal responsibility, but it also means their brain is going to brain, and you can't penalize them just because their brain is different than yours. But that is often what happens. And so I had said to one of the parents, I had said, let me just ask you this, like, how much money would you say you spend in some of these oils and different vision therapies? And they were like, oh, several hundred dollars, really hard. And I said, and why, I'm just curious, why not consider something like medication? There's actually really good research outcomes for medication, and it goes in and out of the system pretty quickly. So you don't have to feel like, oh my gosh, I'm doping up my kid, but this would be really, really helpful.
Right.
And they said, well, I don't want to be dependent on that. Right. And I said, but you're kind of dependent on the essential oils and you're dependent on the vision therapy. And is it even... I mean, you can sprinkle as much peppermint as you want. The focus is not going to change dramatically.
Right. It's not like you take ADHD meds and your ADHD gets worse when you're off meds. You just same old.
Yeah. You're you.
Yeah.
Right.
And then also, like, what about spending that on some like really good information, spending time with your kid, doing, you know what I'm saying? Like getting them into more recreational opportunities.
Yes. Find out what's regulating,
like,
for them.
healthy nutrition. Yeah.
Yeah. Understanding their interoceptive cues, how to, you know, all sorts of different things that can be beneficial. And like you were saying around the ABA therapy, I think a lot of these parents, I'm not shaming parents, parenting is hard, life is hard, and a lot of parents are doing the best they can. It's obviously an investment they're making to try and improve things for their child. But also, it's okay to question medicine, and it's also okay to question why we feel the way we do about medication. Often there's a family history of how our family regarded medication. Sometimes there's some overcorrections of everybody in my family was dependent on it. I don't want that life for me. But again, like you said, it gets reduced down to this idea almost of a personal flaw if you need that support.
Then also, if I can just throw out there, one of the hugest, most impactful things a parent can do to help their kid of any neurotype is, can you put some financial resources towards your own therapy as a patient for your own emotional regulation, your own self-understanding, and then show up in your most fullest self with your kid.
Right. Yes. A regulated adult is going to have such a...
Therapy for parents, please.
Yes. Right. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And they'll just, like, you know, go, yeah, I feel like, and I feel like any really, really strong child therapist is going to be working with you intensely as a parent and your parenting.
Yeah, because you're the expert too on your kid, and also have such an incredible relationship and an impact on on a lot of the different dynamics at home and how life is functioning. And so being able to be a part of that team, you are such an important part of that team. But sometimes, you know, whether it's I haven't bought myself a new shirt because I'm getting the kids clothes every season, down to I haven't done my own therapy because I'm paying all this for little Jimmy to get enough of the essential oils or whatever, or medication or anything else, right? Sometimes we just need to stop and go, oh, I haven't taken care of myself in a long time. And the adage that people will often hear in this field, and I know I've used it and many of us have used it, is we got to put that oxygen mask on ourselves first before we're going to be able to assist and help anybody else with putting on their oxygen mask, because we have to be taking care of our mental health. We have to be investing in our ability to regulate and decompress, or it is going to come out in effect the people around us, kids, partners, parents, all of that. So there's so many interesting things that I know that we could talk about, and I think mm-hmm. this has been so helpful. One of the mm-hmm. things I definitely wanted to discuss as well, it kind of goes along with this idea of, you know, perceiving a personal flaw or something about ourselves and how we view ourselves. It made me think of the conversation about the differences between OCD and OCPD. And OCPD, for any family listening, is obsessive compulsive personality disorder. And it is different than OCD. But what I hear and what I was sharing with Stacey before we started recording, and we've had past conversations on this as well, is a lot of times when we talk about OCPD in the community, there's a lot of feedback, some strong feedback, particularly from neurodivergent communities and mainly within the autistic community, going, well, what you're describing as how OCPD is functioning sounds a lot to me just like me as an autistic person. And I know we've had a conversation before differentiating how a neurotype and how we're processing the world is different than a personality trait or disorder. And so I'd love if we could just take a moment and discuss that more, because I think it is, again, a lot of this comes down to nuancing and it can be tricky to kind of parse out and understand. And so I'd love if we could just take a minute and chat about that.
Cool. Yeah, I have a fun video I did with other clinicians, a dragon differential diagnosis with different dragon stories to differentiate OCD versus OCPD. I would say that, again, thinking about the experience of the individual and what's driving the behavior with OCPD, it's being driven by a need for perfectionism, for it to be good enough. And it is pretty rewarding for the individual when they're doing the behavior versus OCD, driven by fear.
Distress.
Yeah, fear, avoiding distress, discomfort. So, you know, I give as an example, like someone with contamination OCD, maybe they're like, did my dishes really get washed well enough in the dishwasher? Okay, let me run the wash cycle again. Let me examine them. Let me examine them one more time before I eat with these dishes. And then it's bothersome mm-hmm. to them because they're washing dishes and it still doesn't feel like, is it really clean? Am I really okay? Mm-hmm. The fear doesn't decrease. They don't get that full reassurance that a non-OCD brain would be like, oh, is it clean? Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. I'm good. Okay. All right. And then with OCPD, it's like, this is the right way to load the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. This is the way that is the best, most perfect way. And any other way is wrong mm-hmm. and incorrect. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy and proud. They often take pride in like how well these dishes are loaded into this dishwasher in this organized way. And it's my family member who's like, well, stop bugging me about how I load the dishwasher. Give me a little grace here mm-hmm. with this perfectionism. And it's getting, and it causes an issue for other people, honestly, first, mm-hmm. where they're aggravated by the need for it to be just right. And that person has it as a source of pride.
Yeah. So when we look at that dishwasher example, and I think that's a great example to look into, and now we kind of approach it, we put OCPD aside and say maybe mm-hmm. as an autistic person, there is a preference or a regulatory
kind of quality. Okay, so like an autistic person might be like, I need to do this at this particular time of day. Like with autism, the need for sameness and routine helps us because it's dysregulating for our nervous systems, for our prediction to not match reality. for our expectations of what's going to happen to not match the reality, right? And so then, and then the nervous system is like, oh, there's theories about that having to do with how we're taking in so much more sensory information. The cognitive load is greater. We're perceiving more details, the bottom-up thinking processing, et cetera. But anyways, at the end of the day, autistic people are more dysregulated by surprises, mm-hmm. Not meeting expectations. So it's like, oh, surprise. You thought you were going to go chill outside, but your loved one's like, stop what you're doing and load the dishwasher now. Right? And then you have to shift gears and do an unexpected thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So it's that change in routine. It's not what was expected. And it's also, you know, say it is what was expected, then now that's kind of fitting into the format of, okay, this feels regulating because this is what I expected. That's different than there is one right way.
Right.
I have the moral high ground on the right wayness of this. I'm taking pride in that.
All you other peeps are sloppy.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. And so there's some, while they can co-occur, someone can be autistic and also have OCPD, they also are distinct and different when we're thinking about a neuroprocessing type versus a personality trait that can reach that disordered level where it is interfering with that person's social relationships or their work or home life, etc. And so I think it's another one of those things where it really pays to be curious, because if we go, well, it looks like maybe the person with OCPD and the autistic person loading the dishwasher are doing the same exact thing, but it's serving a different function of this is what I expected. It's regulatory. And then I'm going to go on to the next part of my day. And I always do the cups first and then I do the silverware because I don't want to get.
So like I would say, with the autistic person, maybe it's driven by need and regulation. OCD person is driven by should.
How it's
the
supposed
best
to be.
Way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Supposed to, right? And OCD person is driven by, oh my God, I must do this or something terrible is going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are some really good distinctions. And I think that's definitely very helpful. Another example, just to kind of help solidify it for people listening, let's take the case of writing an email, okay? Somebody with OCD may reread that email or even rewrite or retype that email multiple times, fearing that maybe they didn't say something correctly. And there may even be a perfectionistic quality to it, but that perfectionism roots back to that distress of there's going to be some kind of harm. Maybe I'll lose a job. Maybe it'll, you know, some kind of negative outcome that's going to be linked to this if they don't do it correctly. There is more an OCD profile of how writing an email could look. Then writing an email from an OCPD perspective could be, I am really a good writer and praised for my great penmanship or writing, and I am a good communicator, and I have to perfectly communicate what needs to go out in this email. And it may take a certain amount of time. Maybe it is going to be reread to make sure this was the best possible email. And again, it can look very similar, but again, the function of it is going to be very different. In a third case scenario, if we have somebody, perhaps an autistic person writing an email, there might be some social fears or pressures of like, I hope I'm reading the room correctly. Mm-hmm. I'm asking for something. I'm feeling vulnerable. This is hard. There might be some regulatory quality in rereading the script and going, do I feel confident in what I wrote? Yeah, I like that, right? And so we could see three different scenarios, OCD, OCPD, and then a person that may be just processing how they're communicating in a different way. And they all function in separate ways, right? And so really being curious and going, how is this operating? How are we operating in each of these scenarios can inform us on if there's something to do, something to change, something to support.
Right.
Right. And so it can look very similar, and it can be very easy to go, oh, well, then that's clearly because they're dealing with OCPD, or that's clearly because this is their OCD, or that's clearly because they're autistic. A lot of things aren't that clear, right? We need to be curious and go, okay, this is what I'm seeing. What are you feeling? We need to be able to collaborate. And I think it just goes back to that point of that importance of communication and trust with your provider.
Yeah. And you can have all three too.
Right. Right. Absolutely. You can absolutely have all three. Oh, well, this has been so helpful.
And
I just appreciate you taking the time again. I know that as a psychiatrist, I'm sure you're so busy, but particularly when we find the unicorns, I told you before, you're a unicorn that can notice OCD, really knows it.
A rainbow unicorn,
yes,
specifically.
There you go. I love that. And so just having more time with you.
Yeah, I did a rainbow unicorn themed presentation on autism at the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, and to that
That's
end.
That's why I said that. Yes.
To the end, family, I'm going to link Stacy's YouTube channel. I'm going to give you all the deets on Stacy over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Because this is so important. And one of the things that you have a particular talent for, Stacy, is creatively and leaning into special interests and your education and desire to help people understand these disorders and psychiatry better. You present such a compelling, informative workshop or webinar or video that can make learning so accessible. And I really love that because I think being creative, sometimes just reading or hearing things about medication, it's like, man, that can be hard to process. But a rainbow unicorn presentation on what it means to be autistic, you're like, I'm here for it. I'm intrigued. Whether it's me or not, I'm intrigued, right?
Yeah.
And so thank you for everything that you do and the ways that you make learning so fun, but also understandable and relatable.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just appreciate you.
Aw, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
But I really appreciate you too, Nicole. Thank you. Thank you for your really nuanced and inspiring conversation.
Oh, thank you. And thanks again.
Intrusive thoughts. All righty. So another big thank you to Stacy Greeter. Twice in roughly 6 months, I get to have the wonderful doc here to share more about her insights, her lived experience, her clinical experience. And again, I could not recommend the different fun, creative, fanfic-filled presentations that she has. So definitely jump on over to this episode's blog. Check out Stacy Greeter. You will not regret it. And that brings us to today's intrusive thought segment, which for newer family joining us is my application segment of the show. It's that part of the show where I try to distill some pieces of our conversation from today into a practical application that we can practice this week. Because sometimes we can hear things and go, oh, that's all well and good, but how do I do that? How do I implement that? So no worries, fam. We're in this together. I got your back. And I have a quick little exercise to go over with you. And this quick little practice highlights the goal of autonomy and trust in neurodivergent affirming OCD care. So what I want us to do is I want us to think about our loved one, maybe even ourselves if we have OCD or if we're neurodivergent or a patient or a client or a bestie, roomie. And I want you to reflect and respond to these three different questions. And I'm going to have these questions posted over on the blog as well if you want to go. I know sometimes it's like hearing it is one thing, but am I going to be able to jot it down? It's a lot easier if we have a visual reference point. So if you want to jump over to the blog, you can check it out. But here's the exercise. Number one, how would you explore the difference between a regulatory routine and a compulsive behavior? And this is aiming to help us expand our neurodivergent affirming lens, our filter, our viewpoint, how to be more curious. I think it's a really important question to be asking. So that's number one. Number two, what are two ways you could support your person in reclaiming autonomy and choice while still addressing OCD? Now, as Stacy and I discussed earlier, this is a tough one, right? Because it is nuanced. It is tricky.
But again, it's not just for you to figure out. This is where you can empower your loved one, your person, whether you're helping your son through therapy or treating a client. Collaborate with them. How can they have a voice in this? How can they have some choice in this? And like Stacey said, sometimes they may be like, I don't even trust myself, y'all. My whole world, I haven't been able to trust myself. So how can we access, how can we promote and give space to that authentic experience? And last but not least, number three, how can you talk with your person about their experience without dismissing their sensory or emotional needs? Now, again, I think, and I'll just speak as a parent, I'll speak from my own lived experience. There are definitely times that I am trying to affirm and validate feelings for kids or other loved ones in my life. But sometimes I'm going to be like, but this isn't the thing. And it's going to feel dismissive. This is not going to be perfect. And our aim isn't to be perfect people. We need to have some grace and some compassion for ourselves that we're trying our best. But really, this is about how can we understand the difference in how someone else is experiencing something. An autistic person may have different sensory or emotional needs than the person next to them. We may even be dismissing their own experiences. They've masked for so long and they feel like this is what's expected of me. Unraveling all of that is really hard. But creating that safe space where you can go, are you feeling dismissed? Are we dismissing something? What is your sensory experience? What is your emotional need here? Again, if you remember back to the OT goal that I talked with Stacey about for one of my kiddos, saying, gosh, I hated that I had to stop this really fun activity to do this really challenging one. It could have resolved a lot of the overwhelm that made a particular transition hard. And at face value, it may have looked like that original goal, reducing the quote-unquote meltdown from 10 to 5 minutes. But it wasn't addressing and empowering the need. And so the need was, gosh, this sucks and I'm disappointed, mad maybe, sad maybe. Maybe I'm anxious that I'm going to be able to do the other task successfully. We don't know if we don't ask. And all of these three different questions are a great way if you are seeing a treatment therapist and you're like, I would love to incorporate more neurodivergent affirming principles into our therapy experience. Or if you're the provider and you're like, yeah, I would love to do more neurodivergent affirming care, but I don't know exactly what that means. This isn't the fix, like many things. There's no magic wand. But this is a really, really good place to expand curiosity in a way that promotes neurodivergent affirming care. So fam, I hope this was helpful. And this is obviously a very special tug on my heartstrings as a mom of amazing kids. Yes, they're autistic, but they're kids. They're my kids. They're your kids. They're our clients. They're our friends. They're our neighbors. They belong. You belong. Stacy belongs just because of who you are. So thank you for joining us, and thank you for learning alongside about neurodivergent affirming care. Take care, stay safe, and just know you're not alone. You belong, and we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Stacy and me celebrating neurodiversity. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment?
Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.